There was a death on board the flying boat after its last stop in Bermuda. A crew member, not a passenger. Well, hey, folks, how are you? This is Keith Tyler, your broadcaster friend, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for tuning in. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Terrence Faraday bring us our first story. It's called Margot and the Dixie Clipper. Your birds have flown, gone to Mexico, according to the staff at their Connecticut estate. We're trying to verify that. Margot Banning was watching the speaker, an FBI agent named Peter Mitchell, with particular interest. Not because he happened to be a handsome, if badly shaved, young man, but because Mitchell was closely observing the man seated right beside Margot, a radio detective, an amateur counter-espionage agent named Philip St. Pierre. Margot couldn't turn her head and observe St. Pierre herself. He would have resented something that blatant. If they'd been facing a mirror instead of the agent's desk, she would have studied St. Pierre discreetly in the glass. But there was no mirror, so Margot had to make do with the next best thing. Mitchell's frank brown eyes. So far, she read confusion in those eyes, and growing concern. Mitchell had been briefing them about the search for Count Constantine Volganzy and his wealthy wife, Vera. The Count was a Nazi sympathizer and almost certainly a Nazi agent. St. Pierre and Margot had been his unwilling guests only days earlier. They'd escaped through the timely intervention of Vera Volganzy, a fact to which Mitchell now alluded. As you requested, we're treating Countess Volganzy as a fugitive along with her husband. So, if he hasn't already figured out that she saved your necks, we won't give her away. If the Count has figured it out, the Countess may be occupying a shallow grave. Mitchell paused. To gauge St. Pierre's reaction, Margot decided this time the FBI agent's eyes revealed genuine alarm. Margot seconded the emotion. Since St. Pierre had announced to the world via Gotham goings-on, the weekly radio show on which he did crime commentary, that he intended to rid Greater New York of Nazi spies, he had compiled an enviable record and made 1941 the most interesting year of Margot's life. It was barely September, and St. Pierre had already captured 4 enemy agents, one of them twice. He had recruited a small band of followers, including Margot, the assistant producer of Gotham Goings On, and Mitchell, whose career prospects had improved greatly since St. Pierre had become his guiding light. Now that light was flickering, and Mitchell was clearly worried. Join the club, Margot thought. Getting himself and her captured by Volganzy had been St. Pierre's first misstep. He'd rallied at the time, but nearly a week had gone by, and the spy smasher was still prone to doubts and even to dazes that came and went like bouts of malaria. Margot had to drag him to the FBI's New York headquarters in Foley Square for this briefing at which the normally glib St. Pierre had yet to say a word. Margot found herself willing Mitchell to drop the subject of the Volganzys, even shaking her head enough to stir her currently auburn hair, but the G-man missed her signal. "We only found one thing of interest in the Count's Fifth Avenue mansion. There was a notation scribbled on the desk blotter in the study where you two were held. It was in Romanian, and as it turned out, it translated to, Flight September 4th.
"Well, today's the 4th, Margot said,
But which flight? And is it arriving or departing? Exactly. This is a long shot, and probably just coincidence, but there happens to be a plane due into New York today that's of special interest to the FBI. Though there's no way Volganzi could know about that. It's the Pan Am Clipper from Lisbon, Portugal. There's a British courier on board, a king's messenger, in fact. He's carrying something, I can't tell you of what, of vital interest to their war effort and ours, if we ever get into the fighting. St. Pierre finally spoke. It wouldn't be another cavity magnetron, would it? As Margot watched, Mitchell's very square jaw actually dropped. How the hell do you know that? Well, doesn't everyone? Abandoning discretion, Margot twisted in her chair to study her companion. St. Pierre looked the picture of a man about town. As always, his silk tie perfectly knotted and every blonde hair in place. But his blue eyes still seemed lifeless to her, though his thin lips were displaying mild amusement. To Margot, St. Pierre added, "The cavity magnetron is a British breakthrough in radar technology, enabling the development of relatively small radar sets. Until now, radar equipment had been so unwieldy that its use had been restricted to ground installations and large ships. The cavity magnetron makes possible airborne radar. So, for example, a night fighter will be able to detect and track an enemy bomber, and a naval patrol plane will be able to find a U-boat that's on the surface at night recharging its batteries. The British sent us an example last fall." St. Pierre turned back to Mitchell. "Sir Henry Tizard, the head of British delegation that brought over the cavity magnetron, and some other technical secrets I'm not supposed to know about, did travel here by Pan Am flying boat, but the magnetron itself came by ship, which was considered safer. If they're entrusting a second magnetron to the Clipper, there must be a need for haste. Did we throw the first one out with the bathwater?" Mitchell began to protest, gathered himself with an effort, and said, "This is an improved version, even smaller than the first, small enough to be carried in a small satchel. The British thought it was safe to send it by an unescorted courier, keeping a low profile." Margot said, "But it wasn't safe, not if Count Volganzi has heard about it." "No, that's not very likely. As I said, that notation probably referred to another flight entirely, but we have men meeting the plane just in case Volganzi or his confederates show up. If they do, they'll get an additional surprise. I'm told there'll be New York police on hand as well. Another coincidence, but one that works in our favor, for a change." "Another coincidence?" St. Pierre almost whispered. "Yeah, there was a death on board the flying boat after it made its last stop in Bermuda. A crew member, not a passenger. Natural causes, probably, but there'll have to be an inquiry." St. Pierre jumped to his feet, almost startling Margot out of her chair. "When's the Clipper coming in?" Mitchell consulted his watch. "Right about now." "Come on, then. We may still be in time." St. Pierre's gleaming black Packard was idling at the curb. Mitchell balked at its door. No, we'll never make it in this. We need something with a siren." "It has a siren," St. Pierre said as he bundled first the agent and then Margot inside. The Packard accessory list was amazingly comprehensive. "We want the municipal airport in Queens, Clifford," he told his driver of another of his recruits. "The Marine Air Terminal, take the new Midtown Tunnel." Moments later, after making their way east to the river, they were barreling north along it, the promised siren blaring. Margot found herself swaying back and forth as the Super 8 wove through traffic, her shoulders tapping St. Pierre's on the left and Mitchell's on right. "A strap hanger without a strap," she thought. But now she did have a mirror in which to observe St. Pierre, the car's big rearview mirror. She didn't like the distracted look she saw in his detective's eyes. To bring him back, she said, "Two coincidences connected with one flight are one too many for you." "Yes, like a double negative in grammar. The result is a positive, as in, we ain't got no reason to worry." "But there really ain't, isn't any reason," Mitchell said. "We have armed agents meeting the plane. It's broad daylight. There's no conceivable way." "Someone conceived of a way," St. Pierre said. "Count Volganzi, maybe, or his mysterious someone he reports to. The death of that crew member might have been one step in the plan, or a desperate attempt to keep that plan from falling apart. Either way, we have to reach that flying boat before it reaches the dock." Mitchell held his peace until they were through the tunnel and charging up Northern Boulevard. Then he said, "We should have called ahead to the airport. They could have radioed a warning to the plane." "You're assuming the terminal's radio man isn't one of the conspirators. The only people we can trust are in this car. Turn left at the light, Clifford. The field should be straight ahead." Margot hadn't been to Queens since the World's Fair closed the prior October. In spite of that very modern exposition, she thought the borough as the Styx. The airport, she saw now, was in the Styx of the Styx, a stretch of undeveloped grasslands on Queens' northern shore. They sped past a conventional air terminal and a row of hangars. Margot then spotted their destination in the gun sight formed by the windshield's center support. A round Art Deco building that looked like a very short wedding cake with a blue band around its top tier. The band was a frieze of flying fish. Margot saw just before they break to a halt at a no parking sign directly before the main doors. Mitchell, badge in hand, collared the patrolman who had been marching over to collar them. "The Clipper landed just now while she's taxiing in. Follow us." Once inside, the G-man identified and gathered up the FBI agents sent to meet the messenger and the New York City policemen who were waiting to question the plane's passengers and crew about the mysterious death on board. The latter were led by a lieutenant named Rafferty, who seemed to Margot to resent being gathered up, and then some. "We'll need you men to set up a cordon at the terminal end of the pier," Mitchell announced. "We're boarding the Clipper before she docks." "Well, the devil you are," said Rafferty, a large pink-faced man. Margot suspected he'd slept in his suit and possibly his hat. "How's this a federal case?" "We've reason to believe there may be an enemy agent on board." "Yeah, the feds see two in every closet. Go tell it to a judge." Through the terminal's observation windows, Margot could see the four-engine flying boat taxiing toward them, glints of sunlight firing like flashbulbs off its aluminum hull. She looked to St. Pierre to break the stalemate and nearly gasped out loud. The decisive man who'd leapt to his feet in Mitchell's office had given way again to the dazed, doubting survivor of Count Volganzi's interrogation. His eyes unfocused, his mouth slightly ajar. "We don't have time for this," Margot thought, and kicked St. Pierre on the shin. "Ow!" he said, startling everyone, even his assailant. But the kick had the desired effect. Margot watched the criminologist take note of his surroundings like a wakened sleepwalker. "Lieutenant Rafferty was just objecting to your plan," she prompted. "You're welcome to accompany us, Lieutenant," St. Pierre said. "Or we can phone Police Commissioner Valentine and let him settle it. He always takes my calls." It wasn't the most outrageous boast St. Pierre had made in Margot's hearing. He occasionally claimed to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt's cousin. But it was too much for Rafferty. "And just who would you be?" "Philip St. Pierre." "The radio guy?" "The same. You've 1 minute to decide whether you'll be portrayed as a hero on my next broadcast or as another unwitting dupe of the Axis. Rafferty used the full 60 seconds. Okay, he said. You can accompany me to the plane. The policeman didn't notice that Margot was tagging along until they were hurrying out into the terminal's pier. What, the skirt too? Isn't this enemy who's it's dangerous? St. Pierre hesitated, so Margot jumped in. I'm his bodyguard. She waited until Rafferty had shrugged and turned away before whispering. I thought the only people we could trust rode out here in the same car. Why are we adding Rafferty? Have you something against him? Besides his somewhat imprecise language, I mean. If the mysterious death was part of a plan, it may have been an excuse to get someone on the plane. It would have been an official someone, like a policeman. I'd say you're starting to think like me, Margot, but I'm afraid you'd kick me again. We'd best keep an eye on him. At the end of the pier, two men dressed in Pan Am blue and white were untying a launch trimmed in the same colors. A third man, standing at the wheel, tried to wave the newcomers off. We have to guide the Clippy in, the helmsman called to them. Mitchell and Rafferty were both holding up badges, but the FBI man spoke first. The plane may not be coming in just yet. Run us out there pronto. Margot jumped down lightly into the boat's broad afterdeck, where St. Pierre joined her. I can't say you don't take me to interesting places, she conceded, as the launch drew away from the pier. Ever flown in the Clipper? Margot was hoping to inspire some St. Pierre breezy bragging, perhaps about flying over to England to have tea with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Instead, the detective smiled ruefully. In my dreams, but then, who doesn't dream of it? Only 27 flying hours from Lisbon to New York, or vice versa, at a dizzying 180 miles an hour, while enjoying gourmet meals prepared on board and served by white-jacketed stewards in an actual dining room, then a good night's sleep in a berth made up by those same attendants. Well, that was something like St. Pierre's usual chatter, though delivered distractedly. Margot was distracted herself just then by the sight of the big Boeing at close range. She'd left her hat, a Stetson Diplomat, 1250 at Arnold Constable's, on the Packard's back seat. Deciding now that her hair was past worrying over, she leaned out into the breeze for a better look at the plane. It was close enough for her to read the name on the bow, Dixie Clipper. And to see the dried salt spray on her lower hull, the huge wing sat atop that tall fuselage, well away from the water. Two of the four engine cowlings on that wing were also stained, but not with salt, but with oil. Margot turned to ask St. Pierre about the oil and saw him using his walking stick to point out a black speedboat to Mitchell. The sleek little craft was following in their wake. "Trouble?" she asked when St. Pierre rejoined her. "Don't know. However, you will recall that Count Volganzi likes to include a nautical element in his planning." Margot had no trouble recalling the Count's last nautical element, a pirate yacht equipped with a machine gun. She was relieved when their launch moved into the shadow of the flying boat's left wing. The pilot had shut down the inboard engine on that side. The outboard engine was still ticking over. The launch drew up to what looked to Margot like a stunted wing jutting out from the side of the hull right at the waterline. "It's called a sponson," St. Pierre told her. "It stabilizes the boat in the water and provides a tiny bit of additional lift in the air, and it gives us a landing stage." Margot accepted help in the form of St. Pierre's arm as she stepped from the launch onto the stage. Mitchell was waiting outside the open doorway of the plane to hand her through. Inside she found one of the promised white-jacketed stewards, but a short, burly man buttoning a navy blue uniform coat. At the sight of Margot, He also straightened his necktie. Hair? Okay, she thought. I'm Captain Walden. What exactly is all this about? She left the challenge of explaining to the two men with credentials who followed aboard by following St. Pierre. He carried only his stick, which looked as out of place as a bouquet of violets.
You should have traded that thing in for a badge, Margot whispered to him.
I've always found an official standing to be constraining, St. Pierre replied. To the steward, he said, Please have an emergency radio message sent to the harbor patrol. Tell them to intercept the black speedboat that's shadowing this plane. Wait a minute, Waldron said. I give the orders here. If the men in that speedboat board us, Captain, you'll be taking orders at the point of a gun. Waldron nodded to the steward, who hurried away.
How many passengers are you carrying? Mitchell asked. 21. We've been running light since the war in Europe started, and there are 7 crewmen. 6, I mean. One died just after we left Bermuda, a relief steward named Ridley.
A relief steward, St. Pierre repeated. Do you mean he came on board for the last leg?
That's correct.
So how did he die? Rafferty asked.
Some kind of apoplexy.
A slightly Victorian diagnosis, St. Pierre observed.
I don't know what else you'd call it. He stopped breathing and turned red as a beet.
So he was an old man? Mitchell asked.
26. You're welcome to see him. We got him laid out on a cot in the upper deck.
We'll speak to one of your passengers first, St. Pierre said. He looked to Mitchell, who patted his pockets and produced a slip of paper Margot had sent him from the FBI agent in the terminal. Harold Shelton, Mitchell read. The steward who had taken the radio message returned in time to fetch Shelton, who turned out to be a small man in a rumpled suit and steel-rimmed spectacles.
Margot, for whom the term King's Messenger had conjured up images of Ray Milland, was distinctly disappointed.
Shelton carried a small leather case.
I am so glad to meet you, gentlemen, he said, though I expected to be greeted at the dock.
You were never intended to reach the dock, St. Pierre said. To the others he added, That has to have been the Count's plan. Board the flying boat as it taxied in and seize the valuable item in Mr. Sheldon's bag, bypassing whatever security arrangements awaited it on shore. And it appears they still intend to try.
The cabin door was standing open. Margot looked out and saw the black speedboat sweeping toward them in an arc that would put it alongside the waiting launch. Mitchell and Rafferty drew their guns. My second naval battle coming up, Margot thought. Then the speedboat suddenly sheered away. Craning her neck, Margot saw a larger boat approaching from the south.
The Harbor Patrol to the rescue, I presume, she said.
They crowded the door and nearby windows to watch the black boat disappear towards Rikard Island.
Well, that plan's whatchamacallit, Rafferty said. Foiled.
It wasn't exactly a foolproof plan, Margot said, thinking aloud.
Share with the class, please, St. Pierre murmured.
To board a big plane like this, only moments away from the dock, and hope to find a little bag like that before they help could arrive, not exactly a well-oiled machine of or plan.
Margot, you're scintillating today,
St. Pierre said. Of course, you're right. The conspirators would expect the agent on board the plane to have possession of the bag when their boat arrived. Then the transfer would take mere seconds.
What agent? Waldron demanded.
We know there's a German agent among your passengers, Captain. Who else would have murdered your unfortunate steward? 26 years old don't die of strokes, not unless they're doing something considerably more strenuous than serving cocktails and turning down berths. An inability to breathe and a beet-red complexion are symptoms of cyanide poisoning. As you may not be aware, both sides in the current conflict
are supplying their agents with potassium cyanide pills to allow them to choose suicide over interrogation. I believe our resourceful spy simply converted his suicide pill into a murder pill. Mitchell was holstering his pistol. You said something here that the death either advanced the plan or kept it from falling apart. Which was it?
The latter, which clears our new friend Lieutenant Rafferty. That, in the presence of the black speedboat, which tells us that the plan was never to smuggle someone on board, but rather, as I said earlier, to get the agent off.
Rafferty said, so the relief steward was killed because he recognized someone?
I suspect it was because he failed to recognize somebody, by which I mean that someone whose name he recognized on the passenger list, someone he'd met on a prior crossing, turned out to be another man entirely.
No, you don't.
St. Pierre inserted his stick between the legs of Shelton, who had made a sudden break for the flying boat's open door. The courier sprawled on the deck.
What?
Mitchell said. Shelton's the spy?
The man pretending to be Shelton is. I fear the real Shelton died for his country back in Portugal.
But didn't Margot just tell us that for the plan to work, the enemy agent had to be in possession of a certain item when the speedboat appeared? And who is in possession of it?
It better be me, Mitchell said and reached for the handbag.
The man who held it suddenly struggled to his knees and threw the case through the open hatch. Margot dove after it, sledding down the wet aluminum of the sponson, the leather satchel sliding ahead of her. She grabbed the handle just as she was grabbed by her ankle. By Captain Waldron, she saw over her shoulder the pilot was aided by volunteers from the Pan Am launch, who seized her wrists and free ankle, causing Margot to think involuntarily of wishbones and Thanksgiving.
Down, boys, she said, by which I mean me.
Throughout the ordeal, Margot had retained possession of the handbag. When she was safely back in the cabin, she handed it to Mitchell.
Good work, Miss Banning. You should get a medal for that. Wait a minute. This bag isn't locked.
The G-man yanked open the satchel. It contained several large books. Rafferty had Shelton by the collar, who shook him now.
Where's the what's-its?
The spy's voice was barely audible.
On its way from Portugal to Vichy, France. From there, it will be sent on to Germany. I only made this trip so that Shelton would not be missed.
Philip!
Take heart, Margot. He'd never had told us, if it were true.
There are no flying boats traveling between Portugal and France, and there's still time for the British to intercept a ship. They inspect those regularly in any case, a fact which must have made this alternative, while risky, attractive. If the conspirators could only get the what's-its to neutral America, the British could never trace it.
But it's not here, Mitchell said.
Remember what we're dealing with, a very resourceful individual. He waylaid a king's messenger and assumed his identity. He contrived to poison an attractive young man using a suicide pill. When he saw us arrive in place of his promised confederates, he would have known Plan A had failed and worked out a Plan B. For example, he could have hidden the device for one of Count Volgny's men to recover later. I'd suggest looking under whatever seat the false Shelton was occupying when we showed up.
Mitchell and the steward hurried off. The agent returned carrying what looked like a coffee can wrapped in canvas.
So I sacrificed my stockings for nothing? Margot said.
St. Pierre took her hand.
Not at all. If this gentleman had been able to toss that bag into the river, we wouldn't have bothered looking for the real what's-its, also known as the authentic thingamajig. For that service, and for helping me find my bearings, you're entitled to a medal, or, if you prefer, a new pair of nylons.
Margot looked into St. Pierre's now steady eyes and saw that he was, in fact, himself again.
"Two pairs," she said, "and we're even."
Turning to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, a story by Michael Wiley. It's called Awfully Cold Around the Hot. Long past evening rush hour, on the Monroe Street subway platform, Sam Kelson listened to a woman playing an electric guitar and singing. "You're awfully cold around the hot. You freeze me when you touch that spot." A crusty amp and speaker combo made her music sound as dangerous and true as an old razor blade. Kelson grinned and started to dance. The singer looked 18, but could have been 30, the way that living on the streets can strip years from rare individuals instead of aging them. She wore faded blue jeans and a startlingly white T-shirt. Her face was thin, her teeth the same white as the shirt. She had short, straight hair, the golden blonde of hay, and cornflower blue eyes. Her feet were bare.
"Hey," Kelson yelled over the music, "you're a long way from the farm."
Encountering unexpected beauty always gave him joy, even before a bullet shaved off a corner of his brain, leaving him unable to keep his words and emotions to himself. The kid who'd shot him was dead. When Kelson was feeling down, he still talked to him. For the past 6 days, when he was feeling cross at himself or others, he also talked to a plumber named Henry Stickler, who, as far as he knew, was hiding out with his girlfriend in Green Bay, 200 miles to the north. Stickler's wife had hired Kelson to take pictures for their divorce, and Kelson had crashed his car into a hydrant while fumbling with his camera, which was why he was riding the train, and would until Pulio's auto body finished the repairs, and why he was grumpy until he heard the street musician. He fished a 20 out of his wallet and put it in the singer's cardboard tip box. She winked at him and sang about a lover who was like a flame of ice, but twice as nice. And when a pair of high school boys walked toward them, laughing loudly, Kelson yelled at them to shut up, then added, "Please." The boys halted, each standing at an angle to him so one could punch while the other distracted him.
"No, no, listen to her," Kelson said. "Just listen."
The boys did, and then they grinned as Kelson had grinned at the music.
"You hear that?" Kelson said.
"Cool," one of the boys said.
"What I love about this city," the other boy said.
"That's what I'm saying," Kelson said.
Soon a crowd circled the singer, pale men in business suits, a Latino couple with a sleeping baby in a stroller, a gray-haired, ebony-skinned woman with a bag from the Art Institute, the high school boys. The musician dug hard into her guitar and came back to the refrain. "You're awfully cold around the hot. You..." A train roared into the station, obliterating the sweetest notes. Kelson yelled at it to shut up. It roared back at him. At the moment, a pink spot appeared on the singer's white T-shirt. It looked like a magic effect, a little carnation. Then the pink bloomed as red as a Valentine's rose. As the roar became a squeal of wheels on rails, she dropped her guitar and fell to the concrete. The crowd around her stared as if crashing into a platform was part of her act. Behind them, the train doors opened.
Most of the listeners backed away and boarded the train. One of the high school boys glanced left and right, grabbed Kelson's 20 from the tip box, and leapt in through the closing doors. As the train pulled from the station, Kelson and a man with a cane remained with the singer. Kelson went to her. She breathed shallow, raspy breaths. Blood spread across the front of her shirt. She seemed to have a hard time focusing.
What happened? She said.
I think someone shot you, he said.
Bitch, she said.
Me? Her eyes wandered, then came back to him.
I'm freezing, she said, and she shook.
I know. He'd taken his own bullet on an icy February morning, but understood that her sensation had nothing to do with the weather.
I'm dying.
Nope. She looked confused.
How do you know?
Well, wishful thinking. The man with the cane was on his phone talking to 911. Kelson said to the singer, hold on a few minutes. Again confused. To what?
To me, Kelson said. If nothing else, to me.
After the paramedics came and put the woman on a stretcher, uniformed cops pulled Kelson and the man with the cane aside. Venus Johnson, a police detective Kelson had run into before, came downstairs wiping an open palm across her forehead. She looked annoyed at her own sweat. When she approached the concordant area and saw Kelson, she looked more annoyed.
Stickler, Kelson said.
What? She said. Good to see you, Venus.
Oh, it had to be you, she said. Dealing with Kelso in the past had cost her hours of interview time and piles of paperwork.
I can't help myself, Kelson said. The man with the cane said, he saved her life. He kept her awake until the paramedics took her. You should have heard him talking. Johnson stared up at the man, as if willing him to shut up, then turned back to Kelson.
I hate bum assaults. No pressure from family or friends, no department resources. Why bother with somebody nobody cares about?
Oh, this one seemed different, Kelson said. She gazed at the singer's electric guitar, which lay in a puddle of blood.
Different won't make it easier.
For 20 minutes, she questioned Kelson and the man with the cane. Then she let the man with the cane go and questioned Kelson again.
You didn't see the shooter?
Didn't even hear the shot, he said. Noisy train.
25 people around her?
Yeah, roughly.
You didn't try to stop them from leaving?
Am I a cop?
Clearly not, she said. You carrying a gun?
Uh-uh.
Because if you are, I need it.
Do you think I shot her?
I think nothing and everything until I know what happened.
Go talk to her at the hospital if she's alive.
She gave him the same stare she'd used to shut up the man with the cane.
He said, won't happen.
What?
You won't shush me with those bedroom eyes.
She held the stare.
Go home, she said. Think about what you saw. If you remember anything, call me. That night, an eyewitness news reporter stood outside Rush University Hospital. Behind him, flashing lights from an arriving ambulance strobed against the black sky. In shirt sleeves rolled up over his elbows, the reporter said the unnamed victim was stable with non-life-threatening injuries. The station gave the short story 30 seconds before cutting to a Doritos commercial. The next morning, after dreaming that the kid who'd shot him in the forehead transformed into a subway musician and sang, like a rolling stone, Kelson turned on the news again. Now the woman had a name. She was Dee Dee Hernandez, 28 years old, a street musician. A picture of her appeared on the screen, a professional black-and-white headshot, her short hair hanging over her left eye. Kelson said, I could have fallen in love. Her doctor said that she was out of intensive care. The police had no suspects, no theories about motive. They asked that anyone on the subway platform at the time of the shooting contact them. Kelson turned off the TV. As he showered, he hummed the song Dee Dee was singing until she got shot. He dried and put on gray chinos and a button-down shirt. He poured a bowl of cornflakes, sat at his dining table, and called the Harrison Street police station. Venus Johnson picked up her phone.
What?
Good morning, Venus. Kelson, she said his name like a turd had dropped onto her tongue. Kelson said,
So she has family and friends after all. What makes you think so? And what makes you think it's any of your business?
Where else would the news get her picture? He said. And I saved her life. Didn't you hear the old guy? By talking to her? Seems more like an insult to injury. What did I do to get on your wrong side? You started off that way. Maybe every tenth word of yours is worth hearing.
Stickler.
What? Who gave the news the picture? If I tell you, will you leave me alone?
I'll try, he said.
She has an ex-girlfriend, a woman named Sharon Ziegler.
Thank you, but since when do you share information with me?
I'm sharing nothing. The ex is already talking to reporters. You can watch her at noon and six.
You tricked me into saying I would leave you alone.
You said you would try, but you'll fail. The joke's on me.
She hung up.
Kelson went out and walked to the Diversey L station. He rode downtown, transferred and rode another train to the medical district stop. He walked into Rush University Hospital campus and into a white, four-winged building shaped like a huge butterfly. A woman at the reception desk directed him to the fifth floor. When he stepped into Dee Dee Hernandez's room, he said,
You would have thought at least they'd post a guard.
Dee Dee's face was strained, her hay blonde hair pasted to her forehead. Under her hospital gown, her chest was thick with bandages. She managed a thin-lipped smile.
You, she said.
Me?
I remember you.
She narrowed her eyes as if struggling to think through her painkillers.
We sang together.
No, not me. I danced while you played.
Now you sang. Maybe you didn't hear it.
Well, it's possible, he said. Things come out of my mouth.
You've got a lousy voice.
A laugh rumbled in her chest. She recoiled from the pain.
Oh, darn it, you.
Me?
Why didn't you just get on the train like the others?
Well, I wanted to hear the rest of your song. She looked to the window. Outside, the morning sky was bright and blue.
It has a sad ending.
Who shot you? He said. She eyed him again.
Are you a cop?
I aggravate cops.
My dad was one, she said. I don't talk to them.
Then how do you expect them to catch the shooter?
Who says I want them to catch her?
Her? He calculated. Sharon Ziegler?
The name made her lash out, and the lashing out made her recoil in pain again. What do you know about her?
Your ex, he said. Talkative, like me. Seems to like attention, or at least news cameras.
Yeah, you're a cop.
Oh, a long time ago.
And then I got shot.
He touched the dented spot on his forehead where he'd taken the bullet.
You're ugly, too, she said.
Ah, yeah, but I'm sweet. I work private. You look like you could use some help.
How do you expect someone who lives on a subway tips to pay you?
He shook his head. Nah, I'm riding on the check from my last client.
Riding,
though not driving.
She stared at him, then glanced at the window again. I want out of here.
Well, what's the hurry? Let the doctors put you back together again.
That'll take more than doctors, she said.
Because of the breakup with your girlfriend? He took her silence to mean yes.
Yeah, love hurts.
I feel desire differently from others, she said.
I heard that in your song. I get it.
I doubt that. He touched his forehead again.
When I got shot, the bullet chipped off a piece of my frontal lobe, the part of the brain that controls behavior.
Well, that sucks, but I don't see the connection.
I have an ex, too, he said. First time we had sex, Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll was on the radio. We'd con back to my place after dinner. As the song played, we took off each other's clothes and, too much information, she said. Later, we got married, we had a kid, he said. After I got shot, I changed. And my wife kicked me out. Now, whenever I hear I Love Rock and Roll, I strip off my clothes. In my apartment or in public, I can't help myself.
The thin lipped smile.
No way.
Swear to God.
The doctors call it disinhibition. It happens with the frontal lobe. I understand overpowering desires.
You aren't getting in my pants. I like girls.
Yeah, I figured that out.
Then why do you want to help me?
I told you. I want to hear the rest of that song, he said.
Tell me about Sharon Ziegler.
She frowned. She plays drums in my band.
Always the drummer, he said.
You saw her shoot you?
No.
But she was in the crowd at the station.
Not that I saw.
Then she thinks we'll make it big together.
You have the voice for it.
But she can't keep a beat. She's paid for demo recordings and a publicity photo.
A nice one.
Then I told her she's a rotten drummer.
Ooh, that went badly.
She also pays the rent. She put me out on the street.
But you had to tell her,
he said. There's nothing worse than bad rhythm.
Well, there might be. Have you ever tried living in the subway?
When she booted me out, she threatened to kill me.
But that's an old tune. I've sung about 10 versions of it myself.
I would like to hear them.
Sharon shot me, or she got someone to do it.
If you're sure, you need to tell the police.
No, never. I love her.
You think she tried to kill you, and you still...
I hurt her, and she hurt me.
It doesn't work that way.
I knew you wouldn't understand.
He looked at her, bandaged and in pain, but with something as hard as metal about her. He wondered whether she might have been singing about herself, not her lover, on the subway platform. Even if she needed more than doctors to put her back together again, she would lurch forward broken as she was.
Fine, he said.
He pulled a card from his wallet and laid it on the bedside table.
Call me if you need me.
He went to the door, then stopped and returned.
At least tell me how the rest of the song goes.
When she said nothing, he added, please? She closed her eyes and breathed deep in and out. Please?
So she hummed, holding a long note.
It seemed to rise from the depths of her wound. It pierced Kelson and made him smile because it hurt in just the right way. He swayed beside the hospital bed. The note changed and he gyrated. It changed again and his fingers rose to his top shirt button, which he popped open.
Then he realized she was humming a slow and sexy version of I Love Rock and Roll.
As he popped his second shirt button, he said, "Don't you dare," and rushed out of the room.
That evening, a broad-faced Eyewitness News anchor in a candy-striped tie reported that the police had no suspects in Dee Dee Hernandez's shooting, then added that she was the daughter of disgraced former police deputy chief Raymond Hernandez, who'd lost his job in a bribery and abuse scandal.
Huh, Kelson said.
The station cut to an interview with a red-haired woman identified in a caption as Sharon Ziegler, friend and bandmate of Dee Dee Hernandez. Standing on the front steps of a brick bungalow, she expressed relief that Dee Dee survived the shooting. She said she longed to have her home.
Someone's confused, Kelson said, and it might be me.
He turned up the volume.
Sharon described Dee Dee as the most talented musician in Chicago, then offered the interviewer a copy of a demo recording called Dee Dee Z, which was also the name of their band, she said. The station cut away and aired a video clip of them on a downtown street corner. Sharon sat on a stool behind a drum set, holding her drumsticks in the air, ready to join in, as Dee Dee gripped her electric guitar and sang the refrain that had burrowed into Kelson's mind. You're awfully cold around the hot. You freeze me when you touch that spot. When the station cut back from the clip, the anchor was bobbing his head. He gave the camera a surprised smile and said, Hey, she's good, isn't she? Huh, Kelson said again, and turned off the TV. He used his phone to search YouTube for recordings by Dee Dee Z and found two tracks, a cover of Etta James' I'd Rather Go Blind with 18 views and one of Amy Winehouse's Back to Black with 13. In each, Dee Dee's voice caressed the lyrics even as the words seemed to rip her apart. Sharon Ziegler struggled to stay with her on the drums. When Kelson turned off the lights that night, his memory of Back to Black rocked him to sleep. When he woke the next morning, he was mouthing, I'd Rather Go Blind, lying in bed. He brought up the Etta James cover on his phone. Now it had 27,000 views. He clicked to Back to Black, 31,000. Overnight, 8 new Dee Dee Z songs, all original, had also appeared. Each already had between 10 and 20,000 views. Kelson played one after another. He rolled side to side in his bed as Dee Dee sang Heart-Hearted, Soft-Skinned Lady. He bounced on the mattress to the You Kill Me, Darlin'. At the end of the last song, Please Don't Leave Me When I'm Gone, he was sweating in the sheets. He regretted only that the new music didn't include Awfully Cold Around the Hot, and that it did include Sharon Ziegler's drumming. He showered, ate a bowl of cornflakes, went out to the L train, and at 10 a.m. walked back into Dee Dee's room. Although the hospital limited visitors to two at a time, 9 people surrounded the patient. A 3-person Windy City Live crew videoed a nurse checking Dee Dee's vitals. A still photographer with a camera around her neck directed an assistant with a light diffuser to stand between the window and the bed. A man in a white pants and silver lamé shirt waved a sheet of paper at Dee Dee and said, Tupac, Serge Knight, 50 Cent, Megan, 3 Stallion, and Dee Dee Hernandez, all gunned down. That bullet in your chest is a diamond, and I'm a jeweler. He thrust a pen at her. Sign the line, and I'll turn that diamond into a star. Get lost, she said. A man in a brown 2-piece suit laid a briefcase on the foot of Dee Dee's bed and made a show of unlatching and opening it. You need an established manager, he said, pulling out a glossy catalog. Our firm, get out, Dee Dee said. Sitting in a chair by the window, Sharon Ziegler, her red hair pulled into a ponytail, watched and laughed. I told you so, she said. Dee Dee looked at her as if something more than a bullet wound hurt, and said, I almost died. But now look at you. Lights, camera, action. Dee Dee screwed her mouth. You did this for me? Oh, no, for us, baby. Dee Dee breathed deep, softened, and seemed to swallow her doubt. Oh, baby. Kelson stepped between them and said to Sharon, You did this to her? She looked at him as if he didn't deserve looking at. Who are you? I saved her life in the subway. She curled her lips at him. Everyone wants a piece of her, but she's mine. He stared at Dee Dee. Is that right? Dee Dee seemed defeated. Oh, who can explain love? Well, you can, he said. You do.
in your songs. I've heard you.
I sing about it. I don't explain it.
What's the difference? He was nearly shouting. An inch to the left and she would have gotten your heart.
Oh, she already has got it.
Sharon said,
Tell it to him, baby.
Kelson fished his phone from his pocket. I'm calling the police.
Too late, Sharon said. I already did.
He lowered the phone, perplexed. You're turning yourself in.
Uh-huh.
You'll go to jail, he said.
Yeah, for a little while.
I'll be waiting for you on the outside, Dee Dee said.
Oh, it's an old story, Sharon said. A good one.
Made for a song, Dee Dee said.
It'll go viral.
Sharon said, We will, Dee Dee said.
Oh, stickler, Kelson said.
As they waited for the police, Sharon fiddled with her phone. Please don't leave me. Has 94,000 streams, she said. And you kill me? 80,000.
Wowee, Dee Dee said.
Kelson turned to go, then stopped. He said to her, Would you at least do one thing for me? Would you sing me the rest of Awfully Cold Around the Hot? She closed her eyes and breathed deep in and out. Then she sang.
Well, good and wonderful people, that's it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying thank you very, very much for tuning in. Join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.